Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects, the program where topics relating to the nature and function of Freemasonry are discussed for open review. Oh my, this is the place where those topics that are difficult to bring out in a group of friends can be aired more safely. And so we hope to be providing a service to Freemasonry. And it speaks, I think, today, this third day of April, the 94th day of the year. You know, time's running out. There's only 272 days left in the year. Where does it go? And the summer solstice is creeping up on us in 78 days. It's remarkable that we are here to experience this cycling, and it is it's a gift. We're going to talk today about the nature of the rules of engagement, the guidelines that Freemasons follow, particularly around this arresting question of what's pertinent and proper to be discussed in a forum like this, and what is should be happening within the walls of the lodge, and I think the key word there is should be. So when you come back, we need to talk about the untying the lines of Masonic colonialism. Oh my goodness, there we go. Come back and join me. Thank you. funny in a way. I find Miles Davis in ways one of those interesting phenomena. His music is just ethereal. It just sort of creeps up on you. And it sets an interesting mood for these types of conversations. We're celebrating on the 6th of April, the anniversary of the Declaration of Arbroath. And this was made in 1320. The reason I bring it up is that it was a declaration of independence. It was around that time, there was a real strain within Scotland about the being under English rule. And this was and although there's quite a bit of conjecture or disagreement amongst historians, I'm following the line of thinking that this was a part of a diplomatic campaign to assert Scotland's position as an independent kingdom. This was after the excommunication of Robert the Bruce. And the Pope at the time had recognized Edward I of England's claim to overship of Scotland in 1302. And Bruce was excommunicated for murdering John Coleman before the altar at Greyfriars Church in Dumfries, 1306. A bloody matter. But the declaration made a number of rhetorical points, and I think this is particularly pertinent to the commentary today that we're going to get into. Scotland had been always independent, and longer so than England. That Edward I had unjustly attacked Scotland and perpetrated atrocities. Robert the Bruce had delivered Scotland from that peril. That the independence of Scotland was the prerogative of the Scottish people rather than the king of Scots. Now this is one of the essential points. It stated that the nobility would choose somebody else to be king if Bruce proved to be unfit in maintaining Scotland's independence. Some have interpreted that point as an early expression of popular sovereignty. It's been argued that the declaration was not a statement of popular sovereignty, and that its signatories would have had no such concept, but a statement of royal propaganda supporting Bruce's faction. To this man, inasmuch as he saved our people, and for upholding our freedom, we are bound by right as much as by his merits, and choose to follow him in all that he does. For as long as but 100 of us remain alive, never will we by any conditions be brought under English rule. It is in truth not for glory, nor riches, nor honors that we are fighting, but for freedom, for that alone which no honest man gives up but with life itself. There is claim that this was the template for the American Declaration of Independence, that it was inspirational of that document, but that influence is not widely accepted. Judge for yourself. Judge for yourself, gentlemen. Today, we're here to talk about an interesting observation for discussion. This is where we're going to be stretched to carry two thoughts in mind at the same time. Now, we need a bit of a starting point for this discussion about Masonic colonialism, Untying the Lines, and you can see where I'm going with that title alone. By now, you'll be familiar with the terms Mason and Freemason and Masonry and free and accepted Masonry, you know, the exception, what we give to the Inner Apprentice. Now, believe it or not, I do think that it would be very difficult for this type of discussion to take place inside a lodge, notwithstanding all of the workings, the business of lodges, you know, that the stuff that's necessary moving forward. In some places, it's done in a very courteous and expeditious manner. In others, it's drawn out as if that's the central point of the meeting. And it is in lodges where there's little else going on but ritual work, and there's that big gap. And what do you do to keep membership high? Well, my own observations on that are like this. It's really important for the fellows to stay connected socially. But that's not necessarily the finish of the connection with Freemasonry. It is also valid that people can be part of, be committed and studious Freemason without necessarily attending to the regular meeting. And I say that because I'm quite concerned about the diaspora, the people that are still paying memberships but not coming out. And it's an observation that I don't dismiss. I think that's more to appeal to than people that are coming out regularly. But so often the work, it focuses on the same small group of attendees. And it occurs to me that they are already committed and already into that comfortable place inside their lodge. I used to think in very coarse ways, or when I was thinking more cynically, that this was just pandering to this group of people, and they in fact were controlling the agenda. And I apologize, and I think that's completely mistaken. I think it's important that the social aspect as well as the intellectual or emotional aspect of Freemasonry, not one stands apart from the other. It's an amalgam. That meeting of the mind of those different elements. So being part, of that friendship, I think is really important. But when you get there, then we have to, if we're exposing ourselves to anything, it's bearing ourselves to the fact that we have created through our own history a very high expectation of intellectual pursuit, of study, of answers. And we're not providing those answers, obviously, not because I say it, and not because somebody gets up on their hind legs and makes poor of me for bringing this up. It's the vulnerability of Freemasonry, the philosophy and ethics of Freemasonry. And yet, everything in the teachings of the Masonic Order encourages us to invest in these types of discussions, to look seriously at them, and to see what we can learn from them. This is so many ideas here coming together, but I think it's essential that we move forward with this in mind. Is there any wonder there is so much confusion about the origin of the craft? And I'm taking that a step further in terms of the notion of colonialism. When Adam named the animals in Eden, each knew his name and heeded his call to know the true name of a thing. The old Magi believed, Persians, yeah, was to call it its inner nature. How can one get to the reality of Freemasonry if one does not know how to call it? In other words, what is the inner nature of Freemasonry? When terms get confused, it is generally because somebody has a vested interest in twisting a conventional usage into something else. Margaret Macmillan tells us that about the manipulation of the facts of history. Every single one of us has a, every person has a right to their opinion, to their own opinion. But no one of us has a right to their own facts. Not any one of us. When terms get confused, it's because they've been twisted by vested interests. And has that happened in Freemasonry? Well, probably not as a goal, an institutional goal, I would say. Of course not. Freemasonry, in the terms used here in Masonic effects, is bigger than bigger than governance, bigger than ritual. It's an idea, a beautiful philosophy. This happens all the time, though. Terms can be simply misunderstood if we're fair about this, fair-minded. And to think that the language of the work and bringing these ideas forward is, I'm just sharing a few lines from the Declaration of Abroth, said from a 14th century, 13th and 14th century ideas. Well, the language that we use, the English language, has morphed. It continues to change every year by year by year, and culture by culture. So stretch your thinking out there and realize that we have to take into account the period. And how do you do that? How do you take into account the period of the ideas? By studying the history of each period. In London in 1212, the first known use of the Latin expression sculptores lapidem laborem refers to sculptures of free stone. Free stone is a kind of stone suitable for fine carving, and it does not develop faults when carved with or against the grain, and it's soft. So you can do all the detail work. In London, and that's 1212, sculptors of freestone. In London in 1351, an Anglo-French expression appears in the equivalent. The expression means master mason of freestone. That's in 1351. The occupation of freestone mason gradually got shortened to Freemason, the term in general use in England for a sculptor, and Mason until at least the 18th century, when Lichfield Cathedral was repaired after the Civil War. The dean and chapter employed a local Freemason to rebuild and carve. The term Master Mason of Freestone would now be expressed simply as architect. Had that term been in general use in the 16th and 17th centuries, Freemasons today might have been called the architects. One could ask about the relatively erisis of the Royal Institute of British Architects, what they would have thought. Freemason was a specifically English term before 1600. The Scottish term for the same job was simply Mason. When Freemason entered Scottish usage, Freemasonry had already become an order of symbolic rituals in England and was applied to lodges and loosening ties to the trade. Before 1654, the London Company of Freemasons dominated the practice of the art and science and trade in London. And after that time, the company called itself the London Company of Masons. In general usage, Mason and Freemason meant the same thing, a craftsman in stone. And it's significant that when Elias Ashmole, in 1617 to 1692, twice refers to the organization in which he was a member in 1646 and 1682, he refers to himself as a Freemason. And this usage might be to distinguish his status from a person who earned his living solely from stonework and construction. A Freemason, one word. But I don't think we should pay a whole lot of attention to that. In 1686, Dr. Robert Plott's Natural History of Staffordshire refers to lodges of Freemasons in that county, referring to lodges clearly dominated by trade work, but nonetheless attracting persons of quality who had never served the 5 or 7 year apprenticeships common to working Freemasons. Nevertheless, it might also be significant that when Ashmole adds an adjective in 1682, he breaks up the usual expression, two-word free mason, to new accepted masons. But by 1723, Anderson refers to the Grand Lodge as one of Freemasons, or free and accepted masons who practice masonry. So it is most likely that the period 1654 to 1723 is the one when most confusion seems to have entered the terminology. Thus, we find in modern Freemasonry that members are encouraged to think of themselves as free and accepted, or speculative Masons, distinct from the operatives. The post 1813 modern ritual links the word free to being freeborn, that is, not in service or slavery. Financially independent. Severed from its practical and earthly context, the word free in Freemason has also been supposed to refer to notions of the medieval guild system, its leaders not being bonded but freed by redemption from apprenticeships. The word has also been linked to civic distinctions, just as being given the freedom of the city. The word free is also linked to the liberal arts, liberal meaning free. The seven liberal arts were those learned by citizens of Rome, able to participate in the voting and representative procedures of civic life. And by contrast, the old Masons were frequently itinerants, free to roam. The Mason companies were the means by which the cities gained a measure of control over Masons' practices, particularly as regards wages. Nowadays, it is, outside of scholarly circles, normal throughout the world to speak of speculative Freemasonry and operative Freemasonry as distinct entities. There are those who believe speculative Freemasonry was basically a new thing that used some of the old practices, but whose theoretical superstructure, like moralizing on the tools and esoteric developments, was original. According to that argument, this originality crystallized with the foundation of the Grand Lodge of England, supposed to have taken place in 1716 and 1717. But whose development before that might or might not go back to the 16th century at the earliest. In the other camp, broadly, are those who tend to see the story of Freemasonry as something of an unbroken chain, supposing that the distinct practices of symbolic Freemasonry evolved out of the old guild and the company systems of more gentlemen chose to join. Each camp has generated sufficient historical problems to keep them writing research papers for many years to come. Solving this problem may not be of the highest priority. Many regard the problem as insoluble, unless startling new evidence comes to light. My guess is that we all have the evidence we require. So long as we truly see, take the blinkers off, if we truly see what we have been given an incredible opportunity and a gift. We should hang our heads if we think otherwise. It is fairly accurate to say that we lack the key evidence to support any single theory of Masonic origins, and that is to say a single theory that would convince everybody, especially those who do not wish to be so convinced. Such evidence as we are presented with involves necessarily questions of interpretation. One man's interpretation is compelling evidence, for another is a subjective opinion. I do not think evidence should be used simply to support any particular theory. We are not trying to prove by experiment a formula for the phenomena of electromagnetism. Nor are we trying to convict or release a theory in a court of law. Theories do not have to be right or wrong. They only have to be useful. The word theory means to open up something, not to wrap it up. A theory is a means of getting at the truth, not the name given to the conclusion. If we come to the conclusion that a search for truth what we have is truth, not theory. We are trying to understand something that has happened in history and that is still happening. albeit in a different form. Not known for sure, we can never achieve that understanding since the witnesses are incapable of being cross-questioned and people do not behave with the formulaic neatness of the mathematical digits, so you know. Most ancient histories were composed of hearsay, but without them, what would we have? We should have archaeological evidence, but no story to hold the fragments together. Data lacks meaning until it's interpreted. Eh? Evidence should be looked at in its own terms, and that is to say that which we call evidence, something to be used to make a case, is not what the so-called evidence was itself created for in the first place. A body may prove that a murder has occurred, but that is not what the body was made for. Historical evidence is just a bit of the past that has survived. What we make of it simply depends on what it means to us. Some evidence stares people in the face for years and years until one person suddenly sees it. This perceptiveness is not art, is an art. This perceptiveness is an art, not a science. See, I read that line, and I don't believe it. It's like hard to grasp. Not a science. So you see it. As we generally understand the word, perception is not democratic. Now, it is also clear in the issue of finding out where Freemasonry came from that meaning is influenced by motivation, what somebody wants. It seems to be true that we believe what we want to believe. Personally, I want to know what happened because I'm curious. I like to get to the truth of things, if that's possible. But some people have vested interest in disinclining people to look in certain directions. Can we trust the Roman Catholic Church to provide a completely unbiased and totally objective account of the origins of Christianity? Of course not. Any evidence that might come forward has already been interpreted over 1,000 years. If somebody finds bones behind the Vatican, it is always St. Peter or St. Paul. But the creeds cannot be wrong because they are a priori true. To think otherwise is to trust your own reason over the authority of the ministers of right belief. The church is interested in what people believe more than in what they know, since the church has little faith in man's potential to know anything worth knowing without the church. The church is in the salvation, not the science business. And the church is a nice distinction for really annoying problems. There are statements of faith and there are statements of science. Faith is everlasting. Science is transitory. New theories come into play every year. Guess which statement should hold the attention of Catholics? Whoever's playing the game, the church must win. So, keep that in mind as I share with you the commentary this week on untying the lines of Masonic colonialism. Here, when we come back, we're going to talk about this. What in the world am I getting at with that approach. Think about how it might have been another day. Traveling. Rachel Yamagata. The commentary today, though, has to do with the movement and an understanding of the nature of Freemasonry as a freestanding organization, or whether it has evolved within that land, in that tapestry of colonialism. Not going to judge whether that's necessarily of any benefit. There were tragedies and there were significant gains as a result of colonialism, a period of our erasable history. Right is right. Today, we have the advantage of examining trends in history at our leisure. For some, it is not a convenience, but an essential step in explaining what is happening around us today. How did we get where we are? Where were we when we started this trip? In a secular world, which is what most of us in Europe and North America live in, history takes us on the role of showing us good and evil, virtues and vices. That was Dr. Margaret Macmillan's thought on the value of history in a secular world. Freemasonry has a history within a history within a history. So the level of analysis may not tell the whole story. I wasn't born into Freemasonry. I don't know how anyone would be born into it. So I don't have that sense of entitlement. You know what I mean? And Prince of Rhode Island was just assumed. I don't know if we were born into it. It's like being born into my Scottish heritage. I didn't expect to find a wide stream of men who joined, but quickly stopped attending. It was a little clearer when I realized the scholarship and mentoring wasn't available. Advancement by merit was very slack. Rather than best effort, good enough was standard for the day. And I didn't expect the apologists who chased after disillusioned fellows, chasing them further away. How could an organization based on grand ideas with a remarkable pedigree, with continuous history, have failed to define and operationalize success? It staggered my imagination that an order professing to be on pilgrimage of enlightenment would be so thin-skinned. For all that it was based on an extraordinary body of work, the workings of craft masonry was unappealing. So the Masonic narrative remained suspended in a state of grace, but the story is still being written. Today, a growing group of concerned Freemasons are beginning to retell the story of Freemasonry, not as colonialists, but driving forward a paradigmatic shift. Is the best of Freemasonry ahead? The Age of Enlightenment. We came out of a period, I believe, and many of the things about Masonry resonate with the Age of Enlightenment. Not that we were born of the Age of Enlightenment. Sometimes that's called the Age of Reason. And it talks about the time of the guiding intellectual movement. And it covers about a century and a half in Europe, beginning about the time when Francis Bacon wrote Novum Organum in 1620 and ended with Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason about 1781. Brilliant work. The summaries of Kant's work. I can't say that I'm a scholar of Francis Bacon, but the summaries of work of Kant and Spinoza, I think, are quite pertinent to a comprehension of the Age of Reason. And from the perspective of socio-political phenomena, the period is considered to have begun with the close of the 30 Years' War in 1648. And ended with the French Revolution in 1789. The Enlightenment advocated reason as a means of establishing an authoritative system of aesthetics and ethics, government, and even religion, which would allow human beings to obtain objective truth above the whole of reality. Now remember, Freemasonry has taught me something about my own belief. I apparently am a deist. I fall into that category that was so soundly criticized in the past, our ancient brethren, that it's not the supernatural events that I believe in, but I believe that there is enough within nature, within the science around us, to demonstrate the great architect. It's a proof of the great architect of the universe. So that's my bias as I bring this forward to you. The revolution of physics commenced by Newtonian kinematics really lit the candle for the Age of Reason, really brightened things up. Enlightenment thinkers argued that reason could free humankind from superstition and religious authoritarianism that had brought suffering and death to millions in religious wars. Of course it would, a 30 years war coming to an end. And also the wide availability of knowledge was made possible through the production of encyclopedias, serving the Enlightenment cause of educating the human race. The Age of Enlightenment is considered to have ended with the French Revolution, which had a violent aspect that discredited it in the eyes of many people. Immanuel Kant was born in 1724. His declaration, Dare to Know, was seemingly the finest mottos for the Enlightenment. And it ended up criticizing the Enlightenment confidence in the power of reason. Romanticism, with its emphasis on imagination and spontaneity and passion, emerged also as a reaction against the dry intellectualism of rationalists. Criticism of the Enlightenment has expressed itself in a variety of forms, such as religious conservatism and postmodernism and feminism. The legacy of the Enlightenment has been an enormous consequence for the modern world. The general decline of the church, the growth of secular humanism and political and economic liberalism, and the belief in progress and the development of science are among its products. Its political thought, developed by Thomas Hobbes, and John Locke, and Voltaire, and Rousseau, created the modern world, in a sense. It helped create the intellectual framework, not only for the American Revolutionary War and liberalism and democracy and capitalism, but also the French Revolution and racism, nationalism and secularism and fascism and communism. The intellectual leaders of the Enlightenment regarded themselves as a courageous elite who would lead the world into progress from a long period of doubtful tradition and ecclesiastical tyranny, which resulted in the bloody 30 Years' War and the English Civil War, 1642 to 1651. So, judge for you, determine for yourself. Determine for yourself, my brethren, whether this has merit. Are we an offshoot? Did the Age of Enlightenment help to galvanize the thinking of our ancient brethren from 13th to 14th century and even beyond that? We're looking at history as a European history. You know, a couple of thousand years is stretching it. We gain fragments from Egypt of what, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. We only gain illusion from the continent of Australia, where we're looking at 15,000 years of history. And the drawings on rock, the artwork carved into some of the hardest surfaces in the face of the earth. But the sciences of the, started the scientific revolution. Nicholas Copernicus, Galilei. These are people that made systematic studies. So it suggests you and I should be capable of doing the same thing, of being inspired by that notion of curiosity. If nothing else, we should feel a little freer by the fact that Isaac Newton combined mathematics and was an alchemist. He came up with a systematic application of algebra to geometry. So here we have, he brought about the integration of algebraic thinking acquired from the Islamic world over the previous two centuries. Not the radical movements that have been going on since what, since the 20s and 30s, 1920s and 30s, but from Islam, the world that gave the world such an enriched scientific environment. Now, out of the Age of Enlightenment, we come up with this notion that had prior to that not been stated, that it was the nature of mankind, of humanity, to be happy. And we hear that, to be happy and share that happiness. To be happy. Now, do we know why? Is that we're just to be gadflies? Well, I hardly think of, that's a bit lowbrow to think that that's what Freemasonry is about. And it's not to say that when somebody is just enjoying the good company and good cheer, that there's anything at all mistaken about that. Masonry is if nothing else, an enigma, a wonderful challenge to the intellect and the senses. But like everybody as an entered apprentice, I came, and the exception, what was given to me and that I accepted were tools. And what those tools do is limited only by the talent and imagination and the diligence of the person using them. It's not our history, it's not our order that is the challenge. It's the ideas. Wrapping our minds around the need to think, the need to ruminate, to contemplate, to brood, to be observant, to be expressive and dynamic, to exercise that curiosity. That's what Freemasonry has presented to us. The question to you then, is the best of Freemasonry behind us or ahead of us? Each year we go through time of renewal. New apprentices come forward and others retire. And that renewal will continue forever. Just as the ideas of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, are not extinguished because of postmodernism. That period of renewal brings hope for men of vision to come forward. The man of vision is more likely, because vision is a rare genius that we all respect. And it may not necessarily come out of natural or God-given ability as much as observation and imagination. And in our imagination, Freemasonry instills this in you and I. Oh, don't get your panties in a knot. Those bureaucrats out there that think without the organization, we all fall apart. Without the organization, things are just, you know, chaos. My goodness. But the idea is to use, is to, that imagination gives us answers to everything. Everything. And then we have to prove it. So, a nod today about the untying the lines of Masonic colonialism is to give a nod to the alchemists. Now, I don't know how people can chase down the answers about the nature of alchemy without understanding the history of the time, but I see that all the time. It's like trying to understand cubism without understanding anything of the history of art, I think. But we're going to move this forward. We're going to move this forward somehow, and I'll leave those questions to you. The enlightened audience of Masonic Effects. Nothing pleases us more than to end muscularity of the cynics, you know, that angry voice that's always there to insult and to act as if they're a bit entitled. I don't envy the role of our Grand Lodges in dealing with that type of energy. We may find the most unpleasant character out there. is able to contribute something, not perhaps when they're alive, but certainly something into the conversation, the Masonic conversation that's been ongoing. They may have a different way of thinking about it that gives us a moment to pause. I don't necessarily judge the merit of ideas on whether the person is persuasive or popular, although Enlightenment did give us the tools of democracy. No, think about separating out the individual from the idea. So that bombastic tool that just can't stop and likes the sound of his own voice, although he's an irritant, just like in the real world out there, he may have a point. Certainly, the person that's feeling his thoughts and process of Freemasonry have been muted or lost needs to be able to be on the ready to connect with other Freemasons. Wonderful things are happening in the local jurisdiction that I'm in. In this province, wonderful things. There's been these emergent expressions and forms of Masonic education springing up. There's a symposium being planned. That's amazing. It's wonderful. You hear learned papers, research papers coming forward. The college is refining its coursework for registrants, and we're seeing whole days of Masonic education being organized, and just remarkable, not the product of one single person, but a collective recognition. These are inspiring times. Faced with the challenge, and this is what I really love about being a Freemason today, faced with a challenge that some would say is daunting. Generations of, indifference or neglect or focus on different practical goals and objectives. All of that aside, here we find men building on the foundations that were handed, left for them. And that building is inspiring. And no, it's not all little springs of genius popping up, but something out there is happening. And the work is moving ahead very robustly. The work of reaching those more lofty goals to improve the quality of the experience, to leave me and the likes of me and you with an experience that we are owed and deserve. Each of us not taking without giving. We get as much out of it as we put into it. It's been an absolute pleasure to have this opportunity this morning to talk with you, or this evening, or this night. Top up whatever you have there and sit back in your comfortable chair. I'll be back in a week with another commentary and Windows of History. And I look forward to being with you again. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. This is a little Sam Cooke to take us on home. Bye for now. Bring your sweet love and
Bring it on home to me.